writing this book and doing a ritual that I felt like really sews my family back together each week. It's brought such balance and kind of a reconnection each week that has sewn a strong fabric. And I worry, I walk around, I see families, everyone's on a screen all the time.
Welcome to Shame Booth. This is our podcast. I'm Paula Williams, and we are in day 73 here in California of shelter in place, and I'm going out of my mind. The only people I interact with are like my daughters, my two dogs, and my husband. I need some new blood. I finally got that with my conversation with Tiffany Schlain when we met up over Zoom.
I'm just trying to share this very simple idea that can really bring a lot back to people.
Tiffany is a writer, a filmmaker, and a public speaker. She is well known most recently for her tech Shabbats. It's a 10-year strong family ritual of turning off screens for a day. In fact, she's written a book about it, and that's really why I wanted to talk to her. It's been transformative for her and her family. And for those of us right now, we are turning to our screens more than ever. I mean, my husband still sleeps with his iPhone on his chest. And even if you try to take it away, he wakes up. Like, this guy is super addicted to his technology. Actually, we tried to do a little tech Shabbat here at the house, and it was like mutiny. One of my daughters was really into it, so her and I did a 24-hour without our phones or computers. It was actually great. So I think Tiffany might be onto something. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the interview. We talk about life under quarantine, escaping, and needing technology. And, well, the shame, of course. So stay tuned.
I think it's 10 times more important to unplug now because we're on screens 10 times more. One screen to the next, the phone to the Zoom to the laptop to the iPad, and it is exhausting. This one day without screens each week has been like our saving grace. I mean, I sleep the best, I laugh the most, I have my most creative ideas on Saturdays, hands down. And then the most important thing is that I do my best connecting with not only myself, but my husbands and my kids, and but again to myself, because I think we're in such a constant state of responding to everything and everyone and the news and the Zooms and the texts and the, which is great. It's great. And it's keeping us connected right now, especially because we can't go out. But there's real value in knowing how to sit with yourself, sit with your feelings, try to process them, try to unpack them, try to write about them. And we don't leave a lot of room for that.
So You wrote this book. What was something that was happening in your life for you to kind of come up with this idea, the idea of unplugging, so you could connect with the people you love and have more space?
It was actually a very similar moment to where we're in, where it was almost exactly 11 years ago. It's the anniversary of my father's death on May 11th, and he died of brain cancer. We were extremely close. And within days, my daughter was born. So I had these two very dramatic life events happen. And it felt like life was grabbing me by the shoulders and saying, focus on what matters. You don't know how much time you're going to be on this earth, and pay attention. And so that's when we started doing tech Shabbats. It was a day that stopped the nonstop distractions. And I felt very present and connected. And it's just been the single best thing I've ever done in my life. And it's very similar to this moment. I feel like Earth is grabbing us all by the shoulders and saying, focus on what matters, focus on what's important, and be present. And so it's a very similar moment. And I feel like those that are sheltered in place, I haven't talked to one person in my life that isn't exhausted by the screens at the end of the day, because it's like, it's so much. But then there's so many people that don't even have screens. They don't have Wi-Fi at home. 29% of New York doesn't. Half of the planet is not wired. And it's interesting to think about if this pandemic happened 30 years ago and there was no internet at all. And of course, the marvels of the internet that we're allowed to even have this conversation right now or collaborate with news sources. And so there's so many things this is bringing to light, and we're all forced to stop and think about them all. You know, what are you choosing to spend your time doing right now? And I was just writing in my journal, okay, there's one more month of this. Possibly, could be a lot longer, but What do you hope you can spend time doing or thinking about or connecting in this next month? Because it's also a gift of time, which, you know, as a working parent and trying to juggle a million things, I never feel like I have enough time. We have time now. What are you going to do with that time? How are you going to spend it?
So I want to talk about, of course, shame, because it's Shame Booth. And we talk about shame. We talk about societal shame. We talk about internal shame. We talk about body shame. I mean, shame is so prevalent in our society. And I think that there is a lot of shame, at least I can speak about that, on technology or the use of technology to the point where it is completely disconnecting me from my kids and, you know, my relationships. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a very powerful word, shame, because, you know, because a lot of people come to me either having read my book 24/6 or, you know, wanting to change their tech habits, or, and the word shame does come up. Like, they feel shame when their child is right next to them and they're like, you know, honey, I'll be a second. And they're scrolling through some social media feed. And when they really think about it, like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? Or I think the feeling we all have when someone's trying to get us off a screen, or even trying to get your kid off the screen, and you'll snap at them because you're immersed in your alternate universe on your screen. And it doesn't bring out the best side when you're told to turn off a screen. And I think the word shame is really relevant because you feel bad about your behavior. I'm sure you've probably talked about this a lot, but it's interesting the difference between shame and guilt. How do you define the difference of those? Because I think that's a really interesting, as a Jewish person, there's a lot of guilt.
Yeah. I grew up Catholic, so for us, there's a lot of guilt and a lot of shame too, right? You know, Brene Brown has said this, is that guilt is something that is attributed to your behavior, like, I've done something wrong or I've done something bad. And then shame is, I am bad, I am wrong. So, and that guilt can be a powerful tool, because it can, hopefully, if somebody feels guilty enough about behavior, they can change it externally. You know, shame is a lot more internalized. And that's why it can be so, so damaging. But the other thing too, I found the social media and the shaming of women and young girls, I've seen the damage up close with my daughters, for sure.
Yeah. I have so many mixed feelings about social media. I vacillate between hating and loving it all the time. Right now, I'm actually really loving it, because I'm finding people are sharing really inspiring and creative and hilarious things on social media that I need right now. 2 months ago, I mean, it's like 2 months ago, I just did this one woman show in New York, and it was like this peak moment of my career. It happened literally the last moment it could have happened before lockdown. It was February 15th at MoMA in New York, and it was a show called Dear Human that was the compilation of so many things that I've been writing about or making movies about or thinking about or giving talks about my whole career. And I did it as what I called a spoken cinema show. So I had images behind me. I had a lot of audience interaction. And it was such a dream night. And a lot of the crux of it was, as you know, and I talk about my journey with founding the Webby Awards and then turning off technology and understanding the power of turning it off just as much as the power of turning it on. And really my concern that the web was manipulating us, and the tech companies were going to our weaknesses instead of our strengths with social media and the news and all of this. And at the end of the show, I said, you know, what could be the thing that would make us rise up and use it for all of its potential? And then this happened. I mean, it's just like, and now I'm having a crazy, this whole renewed faith in the web and what social media can do, the power of it. And I'm just, all that I'm seeing people posting, although I really curate my feeds, and that's a whole other conversation, because you can really curate your feeds. Like, you're curating your brain pretty much. If you just follow everyone in your life, you are letting the world in. And I care about my mind and my brain very much. And I only follow people that I feel like are posting inspiring and interesting things that make me think. And I don't follow people that just post about themselves and what they ate and where they went and the parties. I just don't. They're still my friends. I just unfollow them. And If you saw my feed, it would be the most inspiring thing. So I, you know, that takes a lot of attention and care to do, but certainly in these days, it's been a great source of comfort and laughter. I have cried until I peed in my pants this last month with things people have sent me, like, you know, and then the sharing, like what you were saying, you were early on sheltering in place and a lot of people weren't. I felt like we were all in different acts of a movie. And some people were like in act one, some were in act two. And I had a friend in Italy early on who was like, everyone's dying. They are stacking up bodies outside of the morgue. And no one was believing or listening to Italy. And then of course we were. And that was all through social media. So it's very powerful right now. So it's actually counteracting the way I was feeling 2 months ago. But, you know, will this stay? And did we, the tech companies just got infinitely more powerful, and are they going to abuse that power or are they not? And what's the oversight and the fake news? And
I totally want to relate to the idea about the technology, because I have been so cynical and critical, judgmental, you know, technology. It's this thing that we've become so addicted to that we can't even like make eye contact with somebody who's sitting right next to us. Our necks are crooked as we're walking down, you know, the streets in our neighborhood because we're on our screens, like all that stuff. And I was getting so frustrated and frustrated with my kids and my husband who are addicted to it. And now that this has started, I have to say my whole view around technology, yes, has completely shifted. I see so many of the amazing mm-hmm. possibilities, and also that we do have choices on what we are going to engage in and what we are not. And I've had to turn off all of the news for a good couple weeks. I wasn't getting anything helpful except just shelter in place, wash your hands, wear a mask, social distancing. And like Tiffany, I couldn't see the numbers. I couldn't see I just couldn't do it. It was too anxiety provoking for me.
Yeah. So there's a certain point. It's like, there's no new data we need. We have to stay in place. We have to wash our hands, just like what you said. And the new stats are only going to stress you out more. I check it like in the morning and at night. I still do. It has been so profound to turn off screens one day a week. So that's been a 10-year practice, right? But then it started integrating these mini interventions the other 6 days. So when I wake up, after the election, you know, I was always looking at my phone, the news, when I woke up, and it would stress me out so much. So no, I'm not letting that frame my day. So I do use my phone for an alarm clock. I've tried a lot of other things, aromatic wake ups, nothing quite works. And, but I have it on airplane mode, and I go to get my coffee and I sit in my writing chair, cause I do my best writing very early in the morning. And I open up a journal that asks me 3 things that I'm grateful for. I always try to make those different things, so I'm not repeating myself. And then 3 things that would make today great, thinking about the day, and I'm not looking at my phone. And then before I go to bed, I have a different journal near my bed, because that one's near my writing chair. There's one near my bed that, you know, what happened today? Did you get outside? What did you eat? Did you sleep well? What's your intention for the next day? It's like this perfect sandwich to my day, and it's not looking at the phone before I go to sleep, because inevitably I'm going to have dreams that'll stress me out or I won't sleep well. I'm a very sensitive sleeper. And when I wake up, it's just such a better way to start the day. So, and in my book, I talk about all these other mini interventions. Like we have no screens at the dinner table. That's our only meal we really eat all together, because everyone's on different schedules right now. There's many interventions, but the biggest one, I would say, the one that gives me a full reboot in every possible way, is that turning them off Friday night to Saturday night. And my kids feel it too, and my husband. I mean, it's made me laugh how many people go, oh, you must not be doing your tech Shabbat since we're sheltered in place. And I look at them like they're a crazy person. I'm like, it is the most important thing I do.
God, you're giving me so much. And I'm like, oh, I want to ask this. Okay, so what did you write in your journal this morning when you got up?
I just sent out a newsletter today. It starts with this, it's an imagined letter from the virus to humanity. And it's a 4-minute film. And anyone listening, I highly recommend you check it out. And I've been doing a weekly newsletter during this period, which has felt really cathartic to both things I'm making and other things that are inspiring me. And embedded in it are dispatches from my brother, who's a doctor, on his insights about all this. And this metaphor of the earth being like, stop. Like, what are we doing? Like, we're just pillaging the land. We're producing to no end. We're destroying so much of our earth. And so those are the things I was writing about this morning. And just even literally, it maybe took 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes for me to write that out. And it was it was so much better than looking at the news. And I think if everyone thinks about how often they wake up and they're drinking their coffee and they just flip their wrist and look at their phone. And I would invite everyone to just try not to, and to try to really sit. What did you dream? What's your day going to be about? What are you thinking about? What are you grateful for? It's just such a switch to start your day. Journaling is such therapy for me. If I'm really anxious, write it down. If you're happy, write it down. If you're worried, write it down. If you're excited, write it down. I mean, so it's not like this thing in you that you're wrestling with, but you can like look at it.
Yeah, objectively. Usually, yeah, every time I write, I do a lot of writing too. I've got journals all over the place, and sometimes they're not in any chronological order. I'll just pick it up and start writing. I mean, I think about God, yeah, when I'm dead and my kids are going to come across my things and they're going to be like, what the fuck? Mom was completely mad, you know, these nonsensical writings. But I do, I have to write it down. Do you go back and read what you wrote?
I do. Well, firstly, I'm so happy to hear that you have journals everywhere, because I have journals. I actually have Anais Nin, the French writer. I heard she has my favorite line about journaling. She says, I journal to live life twice. And I just love that, because you can really like relive laughter. And, you know, when I was younger, before my 20s, I used to only write when I was upset. And so if you were to read those journals, you would think I was the most depressed person. And then I really made a pact with myself to write in every state, so that you could really, I could understand all the different things I was feeling. And I do reread, because some of the things I was worried about never came into fruition, most of them. And that's such a lesson I try to teach myself, is the things I'm most anxious about don't happen. It'll hopefully make you worry less. That's an ongoing, ongoing attempt on my part, but it is very much self-therapy. My mother's a therapist. My father, you know, wrote a lot about the brain and was a surgeon, and my mother's a psychologist. So they're like thinking about the way we do things and from different perspectives. But I do think journaling is self-therapy. That's not to say that you shouldn't also do therapy, which I think is great too.
Okay, so you mentioned like your family of origin. So your dad was like a brain surgeon and a writer?
You know, yeah. He was a general surgeon, but he did brain surgery and all sorts of surgery. He was amazing.
Super smart. Your mom's a therapist.
Yes, and she's awesome. She's alive.
Your brother's a doctor. You invented or created the Webby Awards. You are a documentary filmmaker. You were nominated for an Emmy. You've written plenty of books. You've done TED Talks. Okay. What else? Do you have any other siblings that have achieved greatly? Any fuck-ups in the family, Tiffany?
No, there was a lot of pressure. But my husband, he's a professor at UC Berkeley. It's interesting because he and I both come from families where all three kids, you know, his sister's a professor at Princeton, his other sister's a Harvard doc, you know, she's a doctor. And my sister's an artist. She's a painter. I'm not speaking for Ken's family because he had a very different upbringing. But my family was a lot of pressure to excel. I mean, it was intense. I think about that a lot as a parent, because I don't think I'm like that. And I think it's because of what I grew up with. But then again, we all did excel. But it was a lot of pressure. And I was supposed to be a brain surgeon. So that was a big fight I got into with my dad. And it was the first time we really fought all throughout college. First of all, I was engaged to a guy he didn't approve of, and I was going to be a filmmaker and not a doctor. And that was really a hard break in our relationship. And of course, then he later saw me run the Webbies and my films, and he completely came around. But it was a really hard thing to disappoint him, to feel like I was greatly disappointing him by not being a doctor.
So growing up in that kind of pressure to perform and excel, How did you keep it together? Or were there some things that you know, you needed to do? Or
I went through a really, really big depression in my early 20s. And you know, so I had graduated, I went to Berkeley, I was gonna be a filmmaker, and then I went to try to make my first film. So You know, of course, he was ultimately worried about me not being able to support myself, which I think every parent, when they don't want their child to be an artist, it's not that they don't want them to be an artist. They just want them to have a good life and be able to go on vacations and do all these things. A lot of a lot of artists, money is hard. I mean, if I didn't also have all my speaking and my books and all that, it would be very hard to just support myself as a filmmaker. But I have other things that I do. It's funny, all my speaking gigs just got canceled.
Did your dad grow up with privilege or money? Or
no.
So that's probably where it also comes from. Yeah.
Yeah. And he came from like Russian immigrant parents and whose family all died in the Holocaust. And actually, ironically, my dad was told he was going to be a doctor from the age he was born. He didn't have a choice. And it was only he later became an author when he turned 50 because his father disapproved. So there's so much recurring like history of like talk about shame and like doing what you want to do. So I just broke out earlier than him to do what I wanted to do. I have a lot of neuroscience in my book. And so I didn't become a brain surgeon, but I would say that I'm exploring it in words and images and in films. So was that good that I had to push against that? And by not having our kids push against that, is that an issue? You know what I mean? Like, are you strict with your kids?
I am more strict in some ways. Growing up in our household, it was complete chaos. So I'm the oldest. So I got out as soon as I could and was on my own at 18, got into a college and dropped out, went back, and then got married super young. And I didn't have parents who were showing us, you know, this is how you go to college. These are some opportunities and hopes for you. So for me, my husband and I, similar too, like he hitchhiked to his first year of university with a truck driver, you know, because his parents didn't have the money or really the investment in him to get himself to college. So we tried to reinvent how we wanted to raise our kids by giving them everything and they don't really know what it's like to have to scrap and worry about money and stuff. So
do you ever worry about that they didn't have to work hard enough for something?
Yeah, I do. I mean, they've had other challenges, emotional and, you know, some mental health stuff and severe learning stuff and being bullied and stuff like that. But they've never had to work or scrap. And I feel like there is some real character building and resilience and tenacity and grit and appreciation for the things that you do have that I think kids of privilege, because you want it to be different for them than it was for you. But there's a balance. Yeah. And I feel like there are moments where I'm like, we created these entitled monsters. Of course they're going to behave like this. But they do have a good moral compass. They do have moments of complete gratitude, especially when they go off to college and they see that people are on scholarship and or have, you know, $150,000 worth of student loans, or they have to work three jobs. They're like, wow, thank you. So, I mean, you know, I wonder too, just comparing, you know, living how we live is like looking at how other families are raising their kids and go, well, are we doing it right? Or are we giving too much or not enough? The shame comes up for me. I don't know if you can relate to this, Tiffany, around just the parenting and the comparing with other families sometimes.
You know, I grew up my parents had a horrible divorce, and that like just now that I just turned 50 a couple weeks ago, it was the single most devastating thing that happened because it was such a long drawn out one. And it was in the 70s and 80s when there was no conscious uncoupling. Well, I think Tech Shabbats in a lot of ways was a response to knowing how hard that was for me as a kid and really trying to invest in this family day. That's really what it is. And I think that's the one thing that I feel, there's tons of things I'm like, oh my God, am I doing that wrong? Or should I have said this? Or what's a better way to have dealt with this? But the Tech Shabbat's one thing I feel very good about. And it's so clean and simple, and it relieves a lot of my guilt and shame for the other things, because it's such a solid day of connection and good parenting and good, that it somehow, like, it's like this one day that we're all together. But in terms of the comparing to other families, I think, again, coming from a family of divorce, I'm so grateful we're not divorced. And I work hard at it.
Easy.
It's not easy. And it's not something, you know, I have a friend who's dating someone and she said, oh my God, we have this issue. I'm like, everyone has these issues. Like, it's not, you just have to work at it like anything, and have a good couples therapist. It's super valuable, and have regular date nights without the kids, whatever, all these things. But, you know, I think when you're always, I mean, I think back to the theme of you're always trying to kind of repair what happened when you were a child. I think one of the things with writing 24/6 and seeing how many people are reading it and implementing it and it's changing their lives and all these emails I get, it feels so good because it's this thing from pain. Like, I had this painful thing happen when I was a kid of a very broken family upbringing, even though I was very close to both my parents, but just like the vitriol and the lawsuits and the fights between them was extremely hard for me as a kid. I think writing this book and doing a ritual that I felt like really sews my family back together each week, it's brought such balance and kind of a reconnection each week that has sewn a strong fabric. And I worry, I walk around, I see families, everyone's on a screen all the time. I'm just trying to share this very simple idea that can really bring a lot back to people, I think.
Yeah, I love that you said that what we're able to see now are a lot of families and parents out doing activities and things together without their screens. I am like the Mrs. Kravitz of like the neighborhood, is when I'm either in a restaurant or out walking and I see parents that are on their phones and their kids are sitting there with their phones, or you see couples at dinner that aren't speaking, but yeah, that are on their phones. I just sit there and go, well, they're never going to make it. Or, yeah, you know, that's too bad. But when your book came out, I was like, oh, fuck this book. There's no way I would be able to get my family on board with this. And then this morning, as I was leaving the house, I was telling my kids and my husband, you know, that I was going to be talking to you and what we were going to be talking about and that you wrote this book. And my daughters are like, oh, we're in. I go, you would do this? And they're like,
oh my God,
they're like, yeah. We need something new right now to shake up the monotony, because they don't know what day it is. I need to be happy to hear that.
It is. It stops the blur of time. It makes one day feel really special. Here's what I'd recommend is have everyone in the family, and if your husband, have him read the book, because I have all the science on the why in the book, the neuroscience and the, you know, history and the physiology, why this is good to do it. But then the other thing I would do is have everyone make a list of what they wished you all did as a family, and then make the day filled with it. Like, everyone gets a different part of the day and it becomes the best day of the week. It's the most fun. I don't like the word digital detox. I hate it, actually, because it's like, appreciate it. Just like someone, you know, your partner or whatever, it's good to be away from them so you can get some perspective on them and appreciate them. And this is the same with tech. Just stay away from it. Feel what it's like to just think on your own for a day. Listen to your own needs and desires and the people around you, and you're not responding to everyone else's.
I want to ask you, what do you think will be your one thing that you're really looking forward to having, eating, touching, exploring gates are open?
I think hugging. Hugging.
Who are you going to hug?
Oh,
everybody.
Hug my mom.
Hug your mom.
Hug my friends. I just like my mom, I see her on Zooms, and yeah, I think hugging. I hope we can do that again. And I love getting dressed up and going out. I've been trying to still get dressed up. You looked so fabulous today.
I too like to get dressed up, and I just do it for me. It brightens my mood.
Yeah, I think it I've thought a lot about fashion and what it means, because I've been mostly in just very flowy, comfortable, but I'm still always wearing my lipstick and hat. And But I just, fashion to me, I feel like I'm a palette, and every day I get dressed, like, what am I going to wear? And I can tell you're like that too, and all your great outfits and hats. And it's just very fun. To me, it's very fun. And I love seeing what other people are wearing. And I think it's a language. Like, you're, if you are into fashion and you see someone else into fashion and you both kind of appreciate this little, this walking piece of art, it's very fun. Mm. But I think the hugging, that would be the hugging. And, you know, we've been cooking a lot, and but it would be wonderful to go out and eat with other people.
Yes.
That would be good.
I am looking forward to that, is actually eating out in a restaurant that somebody serves me the food, takes away the dirty plates, and washes them. That is what I'm very much looking forward to.
Pretty miraculous.
It's great. I look forward to getting dressed up, both in our hats and our red lipstick and something fabulous, and giving each other a hug and having a meal together when this is all over. I would love that.
I would love that.
Tiffany Schlang. You know, she likes hats. I like hats too. We had some other things in common. I hope you guys enjoyed that interview. And I have to admit, doing interviews over Zoom, it's not always easy, but at least we've got it to connect. Anyhow, here are some recordings that we've selected from the booth that are inspired by this episode. As usual, have a listen.
I think I'm ashamed because I know that as women, you know, in society today, what really helps things move is, you know, not being ashamed of your body and to love yourself and to not post pictures on Instagram that make you look, you know, like skinny and sexual and all that. Like, I know that that's not what's empowering, and I know that any picture you post that's good of yourself, you know, in a way you're just kind of at risk of hurting someone else. And I know that that's how I feel when I look at pictures of other people on Instagram where they've sexualized themselves to such an extreme, and I know that that's not, it's not moving them forward, but I'm ashamed that I still want to look that good. I want to look skinny, and I want to look pretty, and I want to look sexy, and I want other people to see that and to think that about me, because it feels like a competition that I've been raised to be part of, and it feels like I can't win at it. And even though I know it's a game that's not worth playing, it's still a game I want to win at, because it feels like a game I can't avoid playing anyways. And so I'm ashamed that I don't post pictures of myself unless I look completely perfect and feminine. And I'm ashamed because I actually feel like I'm less of a person because I don't get catcalled, which I know is so reversed. And I feel terrible because I know that there are so many women who are constantly harassed and everything, but I've never really been catcalled. And there have been times where, in a way, I wish I was, because even though it's such a vile thing and you would never want that kind of attention, it makes me wonder if I'm less feminine or less of a physical, like physically ideal, because even the most like vile people who are catcalling women aren't interested in doing that to me. And I know it's such a fucked up thing to think, but that's why I'm kind of ashamed of feeling that way. That's the way that I feel, and I think that that's just because of the way that society grooms people to kind of want to be, you know, wanted. Grooms women to want to be wanted. And I mean, but it's my own fault too, because I'm aware of that, and by being aware of that, I have responsibility to do something about it and try to move on, but it's hard. I mean, to actually step out and step away from it, you have to do everything differently. And you have to, you know, I mean, it's a game you can't win at, but at least, you know, you feel like you're getting ahead in the game. If you're not doing it at all, then it feels like you're alone. And I don't want to feel like I'm alone. And it's satisfying to win. And that's disgusting, because it means putting other women down, but it's satisfying. And that's terrible. And I hate the way that women are pitted against each other. But I'm ashamed that I perpetuate it just as much as anyone else does. All right.
I'm a mom to two little boys, and yet I have a very full professional life. And I'm not always the best mom. Sometimes I lose my temper, or maybe I don't listen in the way that I would like to them, or help them feel like they matter. And then I feel badly about myself, and then I'm even more grumpy. And I feel badly about it. Yeah. And I think I'm not even aware that I carry it around inside of me. But I do. Yeah.
Ah, if only it would be true that I could feel shame-free. I live my life feeling like I'm not quite good enough, like I'm not doing life the right way. And I was thinking about this and writing about this today, and I've become quite mindful of carrying these feelings that come from my family, and I think came from their ancestors, and the weight of it. If I am different than the family way of doing things or break the family rules, I can feel the judgments, I can feel the shaming, and I've internalized that and carry it with me. And you know, it really is an opposition to the part of me that wants so much more. I want to really enjoy this life, connect with life, be full of life. And these old ideas about there being just one way of doing things and, you know, one perspective, and it's otherwise you're not doing it right, you know, can't make mistakes. It's so anti-life, and it's so much like a dead, rotting piece of fruit or a corpse. And I want to leave that behind, put that outside, away, and leave unencumbered by my shame, by the inappropriate shame. So let's see what magic I can find as I leave the shame booth. Thank you.
Okay, guys, I know I say this every single time, but every episode when I hear those clips of people who trusted us enough to step into the booth and leave their shame behind, it just inspires me. Especially right now, we're spending so much time alone or with people who are driving us crazy. We compare ourselves with what we're seeing on social media for people who are learning to can the vegetables from the garden that they just planted, or they're learning Russian or Farsi or French. I mean, some days I can barely get out of bed and comb my hair. So I'm using that shame line a lot, and I want you to know that it's there for you. Please call 888- Shame line. What are you feeling ashamed about today? There's lots of it. Please call us, let it go. This is your chance. We've even made up a little audio piece around the calls that we've gotten that we'll be sharing soon on Instagram. My name is Paula Williams, and this is Shame Booth, a podcast series about getting proud. To learn more, please go to shamebooth.org, sign up for our newsletter, follow us on the Instagrams, and get your Shame Booth on. Shame Booth, the podcast, is produced by Sound Made Public with Tanya Katenjian, Philip Wood, and Katie McCutcheon. And Shame Booth, the team, is me, Paula Williams, Retta Roland, and Haley Ireland, and our incredible shame dames that are laying low and staying healthy, that will be back out there representing all over the country. We thank you. Be safe, be well, wash your hands, wear the mask. Peace out.